Third Coast Digest is brought to you in part by 91.7 FM, WMSE Frontier Radio.
Dr. Piero Antuono?
Yes, that sounds pretty good.
You're Italian. Pretty good. That's very generous of you. Thank you. My Italian's not so good. You're a native of Italy.
Yes.
But you're living in Milwaukee now. What brought you here to Milwaukee?
Yeah, well, the answer I give to that question is I tell people that I am under the Witness Protection Program and that nobody will ever find me in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin.
No, that's probably true. Yeah.
But the real reason is that I was starting to work at the university there, and I realized, again, the academic environment was not probably as flexible and had as many openings that I wanted to see over the future years. And having married an American from West Allis, Wisconsin, I thought that I should probably, in a certain way, see if moving to the United States would give me that possibility to of adventure, professionally speaking, that I did not feel I had it in Europe, and
right.
Italy in particular.
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with European medicine or how advanced they are, but I want to get into it a little bit, because the reason I wanted to speak with you is because you are a specialist in memory loss and in Alzheimer's disease,
yes.
Correct?
Yes.
So where are the Europeans, and this is a horrible generalization, but bear with me, but where are the Europeans in terms of dealing with and confronting Alzheimer's disease or dementia?
Yes, it's a very common problem within both continents. And the main reason is the population in Europe is aging at a faster rate than in the United States. So they've come to terms with this issue even a little bit earlier than we have. Even from a purely research and medical point of view, they started getting involved in research in the mid-70s. So the first book published on Alzheimer's disease in the United States was in 1978, followed by and the first one in Europe, which was in 1979. That's when really research started in Alzheimer's disease,
right,
which was up until then never really considered much of a condition, because thought to be very rare and very unusual and afflicting only a few people, and especially the young.
Oh, really?
Yes. It was at that time you realized that those very few cases of 30, 40-year-olds with Alzheimer's disease was exactly the same disease that we more commonly see in people of a certain age whose memory is failing, that we used to call hardening of the arteries, senility, or maybe just normal aging. We realized that that was actually the same disease that we were studying. Then when we discovered that, no, the people who die with memory loss definitely have different brains after death than those who did not, that became then a target of medical inquiry and research. At the same time, we started to see the beginning of this gradual explosion of older segment of the population, which is now represented more significantly by the baby boomers, who are now gradually getting into that age risk for memory loss. So the economists, the politicians, the people have now not necessarily involved in medicine, but have become then at that time involved in this condition because they realized that it was going to mean significant societal changes, not only economical, but also in the way we see the elderly, and of course the resources we need to invest in them, but also the ripple effects in regards to caregiving and the fact that once somebody's identified with dementia, this condition affects the entire family, suggesting frequently that a family member works part-time, has to maybe relocate in order to provide that sort of daily supervision.
Back to the differences between the United States and the European continent. Are European countries dealing with it in a similar way that the United States is? Or is it more beneficial for you to be here studying? You find more flexibility, more open areas to do your research in and to have an effect?
Yes. From the research point of view, I think here there are more opportunities, especially if somebody's studying, somebody's young, it's a more of egalitarian society that allows you to emerge. Compared to a much more structured and hierarchical environment in Europe. The major differences are essentially how healthcare is provided. The quality of healthcare is very similar in both countries. With socialized medicine in Europe, you obviously have major issue with costs and containment. and to do less with less. Here in the United States is really an industry, and it's a to some degree for-profit industry,
mm-hmm.
With insurance companies who do their own business, which is to respond to the shareholders. And so you wonder if they're doing the interest of the patient or not, and similar with larger healthcare organizations. So the quality of the care in the United States overall is excellent. Maybe access is not as readily available as it is in Europe. Well, there is more, let's call it rationing. There is rationing here too in the United States. But in Europe, it's there are more channels to go through to get access to specialists or to medicines. So it's a really, the approach is different. The quality is similar.
Yeah, the whole healthcare conversation is one that it is endless. And the Senate and the House of Representatives are going to get in this country are going to be getting into it yet again. And hopefully they'll be able to articulate it so that we mm-hmm. understand it a little bit better in terms of what this reform is.
It will help me to understand.
Yeah, because you've got to deal with it.
Yeah.
Is there any sociological or economic, does it affect poor people more than rich people, or the middle class more than rich people or poor people?
Well, overall, no. We would say that it's a relatively universal condition. Most likely, it's related to length of life. So if you look at countries like Africa, where average lifespan is in the mid-40s, early 40s, you don't have a chance to express this disease as much as you would do in countries like Japan or Italy, which have the longest living population in the world. Said that, though, we know that there are some environmental risk factors, such as nutrition, economical level, as well as education, formal mm-hmm. education. So that this might be the underlying reason why we know that Alzheimer's disease tend to be more common in some ethnic groups, like, for instance, African Americans or Hispanics. And it could be related to some of these risk factors, some of these environmental, economical, social issues.
Alzheimer's became a known disease, a page in the book, in what year?
1906.
In 1906, so that early. But we began to actually recognize it and speak about it publicly. You said a book was published first off in 1978.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
So are there still cases of Alzheimer's that are going unnoticed or unrecognized?
It depends in which social environment would the person develop the dementia. I would say that there is definitely an increased awareness in the population of dementia as a medical condition rather than just normal aging. And so they'll bring it to the attention of the physician. The physicians in general, and I'm talking about the primary care physician, the non-specialist, has also become much more aware that this gradual progressive loss of ability in carrying out your routine activities is probably due to a specific reason. It's not just happens with aging. There is still a little bit probably more tolerance in regards to not addressing the extremely early signs of the disease because, you know, everybody complains of a memory problem. You don't have to wait till you're 70. You know, after age 40, people are aware that things are changing.
Right.
But again, in the mindset of most physicians is that if you have a slight twinge in your chest, you're probably going to have an electrocardiogram and blood test to see what's going on with the heart. But if I tell you, I think it takes me longer to do my job, I'm forgetting things, I'm a bit stressed more at work because they're asking me to do more, that will be most likely discounted. Or, well, let's
that
see.
That would not be an indicator.
Will not be addressed, yes.
Okay.
Will not be addressed with blood tests or other kind of things.
Right.
As readily or as quickly.
What do you look for before you decide to do what I suspect, given the insurance companies and everything else, are relatively expensive blood tests or tests to determine the actual existence of it? I mean, do you do scans?
Eventually, yes.
CAT scan, PET scan?
Yes.
Right. What do you look for? What's the first thing you look for that says, okay, this person needs to be
looked at?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, the most important thing is the interview or knowing who are we dealing with. And getting a history or a chat or a friendly conversation with the person.
Mm-hmm.
And it has really the main point is to know who's this person. Because if you're dealing with memory loss in somebody, let's say, who has two PhDs, highly functioning, working, extremely active, and they have a complaint of a memory problem, the context in which that memory problem, those changes need to be assessed is totally different from when somebody comes in who barely has a fifth grade education, never had a checkbook, maybe worked as a janitor somewhere. Okay, if they have a memory problem, it might be much more apparent, more severe, and totally different from the other context. Because we are very different when it comes to assess a cognitive function than is when we are assessing a lungs, a livers, or a kidneys. They're all much more alike than a cognitive, because as a result of your life experiences, your education, where you grew up, what you do for fun, right, all of those kind of things are important. So we need to have an interview with the subject and with the caregiver, because the perception of this memory problem is different depending who you ask.
That's what I've always felt, is that it's such a subjective thing. But
very subjective.
Because, I mean, 100 years ago, Uncle Ed, who came to Thanksgiving dinner and just sat in the corner and stared out the window, perhaps had vascular dementia or Alzheimer's disease, but he was just funny old Uncle Ed in those days. But it's different now, and we're more, because we're more aware of the body, because science has given us this deeper, more complicated awareness of the body, we can find out these things. Where does the research in this country, where's the money in the research going towards? Does it go towards curing the disease or delaying the process of the disease? Or is there anything people can do to prevent the disease?
Yes, all of those approaches are valid approaches to intervene in reducing the impact of the disease. And I think when a problem is tackled, we look again at the Alzheimer's disease, the diagnostic criteria, so that all the doctors would have a piece of paper and some criteria to follow, those were set up in 1983. So the first medication for Alzheimer's disease came out in 1996. So at that time, of course, you know, we tried to identify to make sure we have a consensus in what we're studying. And of course, the symptoms of the disease are the first target that needed to be addressed, whether they are cognitive or behavior, because they're relatively complex symptoms. Once those targets are identified and addressed, and we come to the realization that a lot of these medications have a palliative, have a temporary, a limited effect in the progression of the disease, that maybe we can improve 6 months, 12 months, but ultimately, you know, if you look at the long range, the subject would still eventually die after 8 to 10 years. Then research started to focus on the prevention, because we are much more successful in preventing things, including cancer and heart disease, than once you have the heart attack or once you have the diagnosis of cancer. Right. So there is an incredible effort in prevention of Alzheimer's disease, which is led essentially by epidemiological studies consisting of looking at people to see why is so, what's so special about these 10, 20, 100 individuals who developed Alzheimer's disease. Were they all from Milwaukee? Were they all of Italian descent? Or were they all drinking beer or wine? Or what's so special? And right, people have, that's how we discovered, by the way, in the 50s, that these young people who were dropping dead with heart disease had very high cholesterol. And by the way, also were smoking. Mm-hmm. And by the way, also seemed to have high blood pressure.
Right.
So these kind of preventative interventions were relatively simple considering the target.
Right.
And in fact, today we have less stroke and less heart attacks than we had 20 years ago because we managed to prevent them with diet, exercise, right, prevention of obesity. And in Alzheimer's disease, we're moving in that direction. Epidemiological studies have shown, yes, of course, if you grow older, that's probably the biggest risk factor for getting a disease.
No way to stop that.
And no way to avoid that.
Right.
Having a first-degree family member is probably the second most important risk factor for the disease. And again, you can't do anything about that.
Right.
Other studies, however, have shown that prevention of cerebrovascular disease, that is, diabetes, of hypertension, might reduce the onset of the disease. Okay. And those are things we can identify, diagnose, and treat. There are other studies that seem to show that lifestyles, such as a particular diet, might be associated with a lower risk of Alzheimer's disease. One thing we mentioned already is the level of education seems to be associated with lower incidence of Alzheimer's disease later on in life.
Lower education has
higher incidence of
higher incidence of the disease.
Yes.
Okay.
And again, that could be, these studies show these association or these connections don't necessarily imply a cause-effect.
Right.
So it is possible that people who are less educated are probably, because we all go through school, so it's a kind of a universal yardstick that we use to measure people's cognitive function as they grow into their teens and 20s.
Right.
Those people who have high education are probably people who already at birth might have maybe more resilient brains with more brain reserve, so that when the disease starts, probably many years before we make the diagnosis, they can carry on longer without showing signs of disease.
Without showing signs of it. My mother always told me your brain's a muscle, exercise it so it stays strong. I pass that on. I tell my son that.
There is, in fact, a study just published recently in the psychological literature that showed that the who are the smartest over 65-year-olds in the world, and it seems that United States have the smartest over 65-year-olds. And the reason is because they cannot retire as early as the Europeans.
So they still
keep actively involved in their job.
Right. That's interesting. That's great. Once you've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, is there anything people are recommended to do or that caregivers can put people through that makes it easier? I mean, you can't go backwards, obviously.
Correct, yes.
But you can prolong the deterioration.
What you said is correct. We don't have any way to improve the situation to turn the clock backwards, for
right.
sure. We have medications that can stop the clock for 6 months to a year. So then instead of seeing a gradual progressive decline, we see somewhat of a plateau, a horizontal line over time. But eventually that continues because the average lifespan, which is 8 to 10 years, really does not change overall. What changes is the quality of life we provide patients with medications and without medications, so that we can somehow compress the morbidity or the bad things of this disease in the last 2-3 years rather than see this kind of day-to-day, month-to-month progression. And medications can help slow down things to some degree. What's very important is also lifestyle, such as introducing routines, which prevents the person from constantly straining his memory and inventing every new day. If there's a very structured environment and routine environment, If the environment is boring, let's say, for you, for me, well, then probably it's the best for the person who has much less cognitive resources to manage. So we focus very much on the quality of life since we cannot extend the life quantity
right.
in a meaningful way. Because
right.
that, I don't think it's something that none of us would want to, you know, live in the terminal stage of dementia longer. That's not an advantage, I think, perceived by many people.
Right.
So teaching the caregiver, being in touch with her or with him and supporting her, because it's very important. Because essentially the caregiver is our extended hand in the house
right.
in what's happening. And we need to have a good sense that we can rely on the caregiver. Frequently I tell my residents that, you know, they come in to see a patient with Alzheimer's disease, and I said, don't forget that there are two patients in that room. There's not one of them. Because it's inevitable that anybody who is on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and so forth, that they wear down physically, mentally, emotionally. And there's studies showing clearly that they go to the doctors much more frequently than caregivers who don't caregiver for Alzheimer's patients.
Right.
And also, in a study published in the British Medical Journal in 2006 has shown that caregivers, for instance, who care for Alzheimer's disease, 8% of them die after 1 year versus only 3% of caregivers taking care of people who have cancer. And probably that... it's a clear-cut objective measure of how stressful it is to take care of somebody with Alzheimer's
sure.
disease. And the caregiver frequently is another person, age 75, maybe 80, maybe 85, with their own health problem, who need to also kind
of... because it's usually the partner.
It's usually the partner. And so in that setting, this is extremely stressful to see this person who's gradually changing, kind
right.
of gradually disappearing. You know, all of those things that connected you with this person over the past 10, 20, 30, 50 years... it's disappearing, so you realize that this is a different person you're living
right.
with.
Right. The feeling of helplessness that the caregiver can
yes,
have.
Yes.
Is, I mean, and helplessness is probably the most debilitating emotional
sense,
condition
yes.
for any of us to be
in. I would say, I think you've touched on a very significant point, which I think to empower the caregiver and the family and even the patient to know that they can do something about it is very important. And
right.
take away the sense of I cannot cope with this situation.
Right.
And there are different ways of doing it. Even participating, for instance, in research, it's another way of making, of fighting back at this disease, of making sure I'm not going to be taking this lying down.
Thank you very much for coming in. It's a huge conversation, and we could talk about it, different aspects of it a lot, but we have a limited amount of time. But thank you very much for coming, taking the time and coming in and talking to me.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.